They have discovered that those with a simple vow of poverty have a right to own. And they are going to be taxed in a way that they didn't expect. Little do they know what designs the state has. And this is black on white in an IRS ruling. Somebody got to them. Because legally and canonically, a person with simple vows can own. And the ruling says, therefore he or she is taxable. And our government, being the government of a secular state, is still very uncomfortable with the widespread influence which religious communities have in their schools, hospitals, and institutions. They are still more or less, or less than more, exempt. One of the brothers then made a statement concerning the difficulty of maintaining vows of poverty when you are running institutions in residential areas for the benefit of others and for those that are housed in these institutions. You purchase things for the people. You are gathering things in order to take care of them. But often you ask yourself, am I buying for them or for myself? You find yourself being constantly challenged. And Father Hardin's remark, I cannot tell you the number of times that I've talked this way to the little sisters of the poor. Now, they don't come any better. Just thoroughly dedicated to the care of the indigent. They recently put up a new home for the aged in Georgia to give witness to the church's presence in the South, which may be 2% or less Catholic. Before they finished the building, this is just the building, it cost them $50,000 per room. They had to go into debt to even put up the building. Then, how are you going to staff it and maintain it? Well, this is such luxury. Well, you might say the old folks deserve it. Let's say that they do. But you yourself must be very shrewd supernaturally to distinguish between the affluence to which even the state may have subjected you and your own particular practice of poverty. I walk into the homes here. Beautiful. Beautiful buildings. And a large part of our property is not just what I enjoy, but what I see, the comfort. Brother, you are right. I'm just raising a problem, but the problem is a crisis because we are living in a very affluent society. We read, by the way, the speech that John Paul II gave in Yankee Stadium, which speech I was in attendance. It was a very delicate and sensitive problem. Speaking to Americans who have so much, and telling them that they should look to the needs of others and to recognize that most of the world is poor. One of the sisters commented, this is the sad part of America. We have so much. We own so much. And we are never home to enjoy it. We are all so busy. We have a lot. Beautiful homes, Cadillac cars, but the people are off working and they're never home. They're always busy elsewhere. And Father Hardin's comment, I don't have an answer to your statement, sister, but I wouldn't be fair to you as a priest unless I raise the issues, because I want to believe that somehow Christ, and not I, is telling all of us something, including me. Another sister asked, does Mother Teresa's nuns take a solemn vow of poverty? Father Hardin's answer, no, but they do dispossess. But then by constitution, they may not have any investments. There may be no fixed revenue. And they are strongly discouraged to own the very property on which they live. To live on the generosity of the people. And in fact, one thing that the practice of dispossession does, it really does, is that on the one hand, it makes you dependent on God's providence. Nothing else will. We don't depend on our prudence, but on God's providence. Secondly, it gives the faithful, those who have more, through us, the opportunity, the occasion, and the means of sharing. You see, they are supposed to share too. And if we have so surely invested our property, or that, well, the government and whatever available agencies furnish the buildings and equipment and the salaries and whatnot, what about the faithful? Where are they going to give their money? Now, I've had a lot of experience dealing with rich people, as Mr. Harry John will testify. I have told him in so many words, Mr. John, you will save your soul only if you practice poverty. And he is worth $116 million. But there must be Catholic, expressly Catholic institutions conducted by religious that give the faithful the motivation, the focus, the opportunity to give. Am I making sense? Once the state begins to support us, something happens to the faithful. And this is one thing that happens, that has happened to our faithful. One of the brothers then asked a question which could not be picked up on the tape. I can only give Father Hardin's reply. No matter where you build, no matter what the institution may be, 10, 20, 30 years later, you just wish you were someplace else. Because whatever needs were served 20 years before are no longer workable. There are, say, enough Catholic schools in neighborhoods where there are no Catholics left. Moreover, and this is a more fundamental reason, if a community owns what we do, and I'm talking about religious life in general, and the Jesuits over the centuries, we've owned a lot of property. But the more we own, the more we tempt a secular state. And we tempt them to interfere, to have all sorts of regulations and laws, because eventually they feel it's their property, finally to take away the property. For example, we have a Diamond Hall, a classroom building on Loyola University, cost several $1 million. To complete the project, the Jesuits had to borrow $400,000, only a fraction of the total cost. In getting the loan on a low-term interest, we had to sign a document that religion would never be taught in that building. Well, I think the Jesuit that signed that contract should have had his head examined. One summer I was teaching at the university, and just a low-born ramshackle building with creaky floors, and right next to it, this big, new, shining skyscraper. One priest did celebrate Mass in that building. Somebody told the rector, and this is the man telling me, he got a note from the rector, "Don't you dare celebrate Mass in that building. We'll be in trouble with the law." So if we are going to be free in doing the Lord's work and in the Lord's way, we can't take money with all sorts of strings attached to it. We can't live in such a situation in communities with the kind of poverty we are talking about. And I'm talking about my own community. That's why we've lost all four of our Jesuit universities in America. The provincials have no more authority over any one of our 28 universities and colleges, including Loyola. They cannot hire, cannot fire, cannot determine the curriculum. It is determined by the faculty, 90% of whom are secular and many of whom are not even Christian. A priest doing his doctrinal studies at one of these universities had a Jewish atheist as the director of his doctrinal thesis. I counseled the priest. He finally got his doctorate, but only by outsmarting this atheist, because the atheist professor did not like what the priest was saying in his dissertation, which was simply Catholic doctrine. All I am saying is that poverty has deep roots. And please God, the few words that we have shared will help all of us to re-examine, and with God's grace, we change what can be changed. Well, one of the sisters then commented, "We certainly would all like to practice poverty like Mother Teresa. It just seems, in many cases, to be impossible to do this. It would be wonderful to do away with these problems in finances." And one of the brothers added the comment, "Sometimes even geographical locations interfere. One of the facilities for our order is better endowed than another. And these differences cause tensions." And Father Hardin's reply, "Yes, and it has also changed the style of poverty. I've had the experience, painfully, in North Aurora, which is just outside of Chicago. We had lived in what I thought was a very adequate building in southern Indiana. Old, but adequate. The pressure was on to move. So the provincial said, 'All right, we'll move.' The Hilton Inn on Lincoln Way, built at a cost of $6 million, was on sale for $1.8 million, less than a third of its cost, and just a few years old. Not making money, the location was bad. We bought it. I lived there for 5 years. Well, part of the 5 years I spent teaching at a state university and living in a kind of an upper attic, so I was spared at least 2 full years. But you named the luxury, and Hilton had it. Not just curtains and drapes, built-in radio and television sets, hangings on the wall, silver-plated plumbing. I am not exaggerating. Wall-to-wall carpeting everywhere, and real soft. Reclining chairs. And the bathroom had special rays that would flood your body. It just killed a great deal of the spirit of our men. I know it did. And you know what finally got us out? The Scholastics. They said, this is nonsense. They forced the provincial's hand to move us out. So you are right, brother. It does something to us. I know it does. This concludes Father Hardin's talk on training in religious poverty. Now we have Father Hardin's lecture on obedience without servility. This topic is important to bring up because for a lot of people, obedience is a form of servility, where servility means being enslaved. This is the built-in problem with obedience, because every time that I obey, as we say God, it is God indeed, but God's authority as vested in a human being. And I really believe many people have not thought through their obedience. And I don't mean just in the religious life, but even in the church or in the world at large. Take, for example, the situation that Hans Kung has developed. Clearly, disobedience. Disobedience to the church's teaching, and he keeps appealing that he is obedient to God. Well, my dear Hans, is there any society anywhere in the world now? Was there ever a society anywhere in the world, if it is a civilized society, in which the authority which those in that society were to obey was not a human being? There is always a human being. There are two words in Greek that express what we are trying to say. Cosmos, which meant an orderly society, especially the world, and chaos, which is a society without authority. That's a 3,000-year-old definition of chaos, a society without authority. So that is what we are addressing ourselves to, that human factor in obedience, and we know how human that human factor can be. In our own day, it causes a special problem for the following four reasons. First, there are abuses of authority. In other words, authority in so many places has lost its title to respect, and not just civil authority, but also ecclesiastical authority or ecclesiastical society. Without identifying the seminary, within the last 2 years, I have been involved in a case with a young man who was in his third year of theology, a fine student, a good seminarian. He was due to be ordained Christmas of that year to the diaconate. But during the early fall, he witnessed a concelebration of Mass by one of the professors and a nun. Now, the seminarians were told, keep your mouth shut. He didn't. He told others. For example, he told me. He was dismissed from the seminary shortly before his ordination to the diaconate on trumped-up charges. He appealed to the bishop. The bishop wouldn't see him. Well, lest you wonder what happened to the young man, He is now happily in another seminary because others, including myself, appealed to other bishops to take him in for another diocese. But that is clearly an abuse of authority. Second, we can have widespread oppression. There are many reasons for the convulsions in religious life in our day, and this is one: widespread oppression. I don't want to magnify it. I just want to state it. I've been a religious too long myself and too involved with communities not to know that religious can suffer, and sometimes through just blindness on the part of those who either make certain regulations or the way those regulations are required to be observed and remembered. I was taught by the Sisters of Notre Dame, who are now in Chardon, Ohio. While I was en route to another city, I was in an airport, a stopover in Cleveland, my hometown. I had about a half hour between planes, so I thought to call up one of my former teachers. So I rang the convent where I knew she was teaching. It was after class hours, so I knew she would be available, I thought. And the sister that answered the telephone, well, I told her I wanted to talk to Sister so-and-so, and she said, I will get the superior. But, I said, I don't want to talk to the superior, I want to talk to the sister. Well, you can't talk to the sister until I get the superior's permission. I identified myself as a priest and told her I just wanted to spend a minute on the telephone. And by that time, I was watching my watch. So she went to get the superior, and I had to hang up, or I would have missed my plane. Now, call it what you will, a bizarre story. But this sort of thing is not a laughing matter at all. Third, now we have sincere people who just misunderstand the meaning of obedience. We all have the natural desire, we all have, for independence. But in today's world, that desire has been sharpened to a razor's edge. Now, I've talked to many people about this in many stations. And I've read so many books. I think I told you, I read a book a day. And I subscribe to, say, 12 magazines, and therefore receive perhaps 20 periodicals a month. People are far more independent. Especially in the U.S., independence is our middle name. A stands for America, and A stands for autonomy. Obedience will not be either as easy or as unchallenged in our country as it might be in other nations or even here in America 25 years ago. Now, fourth, we have much more education. There are exceptions, but by and large, most religious, when they enter, have had a better than average education. And consequently, the more educated the mind is, even without being a particularly intellectual. Education is many things. It is, for our purpose, especially the development of the intellect. You train your muscles. Well, look how many hours we spend in class. Every day for 8 years of grade school, 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, and in my case, 15 years after college. The net result, even with the simplest postulant, the net result is that their intellectual muscles have been trained to ask questions. They see problems. They see through things. And this thing of telling them, do it, and they do it, well, if you find such a person, thank God. But the more educated people are, the more in their minds, at least, they will change, challenge, question, wonder whether what they are told to do is a wise thing or why they should do it. This tells us a lot about how you train people in obedience. Be sure that the obedience of religious is enlightened obedience. But blind obedience, the term that St. Ignatius coined, I believe in it. And there are occasions when nothing but blind obedience will work. But in most cases, it should be enlightened obedience, knowing that you are dealing with people whose minds, even if their will is submissive, their minds are reluctant. Now, a few points on the importance of training in religious obedience. Why is it important to train religious, not just in obedience, otherwise I wouldn't have said what I did in the title, to be obedient and yet not servilely obsequious, to be respectful and yet not phony, to teach them to be docile, yet not inhibited? That, I submit, is a hard task. A hard task in the training in religious in obedience today. We want them obedient. But obedient, as in today's world, obedience has to be. In today's world, obedience is not do this or else. That kind of person, I don't think, enters communities today. This is part of the revolution going on in religious life today. The training is important for three reasons. First, true obedience is interior. I've seen too many apparently obedient religious that collapse under trial. They have not interiorized their obedience. As you know, there are three levels of obedience: obedience of execution, obedience of the will, obedience of the mind. The A, the obedience of execution. I do it, and under my breath I tell myself what I think of the superior. B, obedience of the will. I submit my will blindly. There are occasions when there are no choices. But be sure they are just occasions and not the rule. And C, of the intellect. The interiority of obedience in today's religious life must be of will and mind. I must be able to defend my obedience before the bond of reason. It's got to make sense. Maybe what I'm being told may not make sense, but at least my obeying must make sense. Is that clear? Number two, obedience must be loving. We do not love except that which we know. Our minds must be sufficiently enlightened, and this, of course, is a matter of years of seeing. Not just the humility of obedience, not just the merit of obedience, but the wisdom of obedience. I see, being a priest and a religious, I've seen great talent wasted. Men and women who offered prospects of doing big things for the church, petering out, never really living up to their potential. Why? Because in many cases, they lack true obedience. I've seen other people, with very modest ability, on whom the council had to call a special meeting. Shall we take her in? The highest grade she got in 4 years of high school was a C. Or she managed to get through. Or she has a high school equivalency diploma. Will she be able to make it? Reluctantly, she's taken. She turns out to be a beautiful soul, obedient. And God uses obedient people. In fact, He uses no others, especially in His great work. So obedience is to be loving. And therefore, those whom we train must love. Not just the person whom they obey, which from years of observation I've discovered is one of the problems, especially in women's communities. If they like the superior, the sun is always shining. If they don't like her, even the smallest thing becomes a mountain they've got to climb. So, no, it's not just loving the superior. It's loving that which I'm told to do. It must be interiorized. And number three, obedience is to be edifying. What do I mean by edifying? We are to witness by our practice of obedience. And all I can tell you is that if a person is obedient or considers himself or herself as somehow having to be obedient, you know, a little reluctant to use the word servile, or the term I'd rather not, that person shows it even by the expression on his or her face. If the Lord loves a cheerful giver, it is never more true than here. The Lord loves cheerful obedience. And for that, people need to be trained. Now, some practical recommendations. And I have four. First, share with those whom you are training the meaning of true obedience. Because while it is not everything, it is important. These are intelligent people who, once you have given them the principles, much of this they can apply in practice themselves. And never assume that people understand obedience. It's not that obvious. Two, stress especially the supernatural motive, which has nothing to do with the way I feel either toward the superior or towards that which I'm told to do. In obeying, whether it's the Constitution or the rules of my community or a given order of my superior, I am obeying God. More specifically, I am obeying Christ in order to become more like Him. It's not easy, but for that very reason, it is so pleasing to God. Three, explain the blessings of obedience, not just as we explained it earlier, although that too, success in the apostolate. It can be quite personal here. Even I have had my obedience tested as much as the average person. I've had a number of such situations. All I know is that one of the blessings of obedience is peace of soul. If you recall, at the St. Louis Religious Life Convocation back in April of 1978, Mother Teresa was asked, "What if the superior commands you to do something that you know is absolutely stupid. She said, do it. It's the superior's fault that it's stupid, but you will be very wise in obeying. Now, it's right here that obedience in some communities is the hardest vow that the religious are called upon to practice, because the same people whom they have under oath sworn to obey are the people who may be abusing their authority and abusing it by commanding things that must be done. I just had a call from a sister, long distance. There in her community is growing Pentecostal from the superior on down. A sister finds that she cannot go along with the antics of her fellow sisters, and she feels very, very alone. This is a hard one. In any case, with obedience in such difficulty is the reason we need counsel. Where must I obey? The general rule is this: I must obey or should obey in everything unless I am absolutely sure it is sinful. And you better be sure. If it is sinful, I must obey God rather than man. There are communities today where the religious are either told or all but coerced into doing things that are sinful. In any case, the blessings of obedience, especially the blessing of peace. Number four, stress the elevation of our most ordinary practices of obedience. The simplest act does have merit before God and is pleasing to Him. The salvation of souls, beginning with my own. The self-same task, or maybe even something less pretentious, that I might have been doing had I not become a religious, yet because I am a religious, all my actions of the day, even the most ordinary, have a very special and distinctive supernatural value. And this, I think, religious need to be trained from the very first days of the postulancy in not to look for anything showy or particularly exotic about the religious life, but from the moment they step in, from everything they do, because obedience, unlike poverty and chastity, affects everything. Even the bed we sleep on, if we don't find it comfortable, that too can be an act of obedience. The food we eat, the people we associate with, everything, everything. In other words, stressing the supernatural value of this virtue is the single most important thing in the training of religious to obey without being servile. Now, some aids in special problems in this world of obedience. Let me just give you four words for the practice of obedience and for how to deal with religious in situations, or especially in communities that have already or are in the process of secularizing. And the four words: one, prayer; two, trust; three, prudence; four, counsel. With these they can deal with many of the things in religious communities that they are called upon or requested to do or not to do. For example, not to wear a habit. I know of a case of a nun about to make her final vows. The mother superior suddenly thrusting a document in front of her, demanding the signing of a document in which, if she signed, she would agree that upon taking final vows, she would never again wear a religious habit. Or take the case of 2 suicides in 6 months. If this happens in any community, any order, well, it just can't happen unless the people are suffering unbearably. So, 1, prayer. Many of these problems no human person can solve. 2, trust in God. Many religious, either past their prime, either their age or their training or whatever, prevents them from making the kind of transfer, say, to another community, which the Holy See has encouraged being done. So trust in God that somehow the sufferings of such religious merit before God grace for all religious to be able to lead lives of obedience in peace. And prudence, all blessed prudence. The first law of prudence is silence. There are times when you have to speak up, then be sure that you have to speak up. No matter how unjust the order may be, and I'm speaking of situations where the order or the facts are a matter of being unjust, you are told to teach a certain subject, to use a certain book, while your conscience tells you, I can't use this book, it's contrary to the faith. Well, sister, you're either going to teach from this book or this syllabus, or you lose your job. This was a case in New York. A religious that came to me for advice. Very professional, very competent sister, dean of a college. She was told, either conform or lose your job. So she lost her job. And she had a PhD, but that didn't matter. We are now going in the Catholic Church through a period of major purification. And among the parts of the church that are being purified is religious life. There is no purification without pain. That's the law of Christian spirituality. Prudence. 4, finally, seek counsel. That's easier said than done. You've got to be prudent and pray and trust in God's providence even as you seek counsel. Because there are all kinds of counsel which can do more damage than the original situation may require. So much for obedience without servility.